The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Orla Shinawi.
Hello, hello.
And where are we, Orla?
We are on Eagle's Climb on the Olympic part of the World Championships road race course.
And we've just watched the peloton go past for a second time. They're 16 minutes behind a big group of, well, literally a big group. A big breakaway. A breakaway of big riders, huge riders. I said it's not so much a breakaway as a support group. Conor Dunn leading the line, all 6'8" of him. But they're all big guys there, and they do have a massive lead. But who can blame them for getting a big advantage on such a mountainous course?
Two green jerseys up there as well in the breakaway group doing their bit for Dan Martin.
You're very optimistic they're going to stay away, aren't you?
I am not. I'm just enjoying this part of the day while I can. I'm getting goosebumps seeing the Irish jerseys go past. I'm not in any way thinking they're going to stay away. Let's be clear.
So we're in the fan zone, just near the foot of the main climb. We were here yesterday for the women's race, and it was a fantastic atmosphere. We saw Anna van der Breggen went out on her own 40 kilometres to go. An extraordinary ride from her, an amazing race. We'll talk about that in part two. The men's race obviously is still unfolding. We'll talk about that in part one. In part three, we've got lots of other stuff from this week of the World Championships in Innsbruck. But it's really a great atmosphere here, isn't it, Orla? Very international, as you'd expect. Lots of people, lots of Irish people.
And I don't have the sang-froid of Lionel and Daniel, unfortunately. I'm getting emotional every time they come past. I'm going to blame the pregnancy hormones to an extent. But I want to cry. It's just a wonderful, wonderful experience. It's brilliant. I love it.
It's very much not like being with Daniel and Lionel at all. I don't think we've ever had tears.
Well, they could come. Just wait. Watch this space.
And now make some noise for the peloton here at the peloton. Cheer ahead. Cheer them on. We want to hear you. Make some noise.
Orla, we've moved down the hill a little bit to the first hairpin on the climb, just below the fan zone, which is on a beautiful meadow where you can overlook the course. Right here on the apex of the bend as we are, we're right in the middle of things, and we've just seen the break go past with Conor Dunn still holding his own there. You still think he can win?
Stop it. Yeah, we're on Dutch corner now. It's brilliant.
Well, is it Dutch corner, Belgian corner,
Polish corner? Well, it says Dutch corner on the road, so I'll allow them that. But yeah, it's a bit of a Euro pop corner, really.
The Bulls of Grimstead are here. A lot of support for Balka Mollema. But it's a real slow burn sort of race, isn't it? And I'm not talking about my skin in this blazing heat. It's on a fast burn.
That's a slow blister. We kind of knew this was going to be the case, though, didn't we? And we fully expected it to be fairly quiet for a good bit of the day, really. And with such tough racing right towards the end, hurting a hurl that everybody has been bigging up, we're not really going to see much action, I think, until the last couple of laps.
You quoted a couple of coaches at me this morning.
I was watching Austrian TV this morning, and they were going a bit live crazy around the build-up to the World Championships. And I think it was the Austrian national coach was saying that the best tactic for today was Versteckend. What does that mean? Hide. And I think that's exactly what they're all doing today.
And Cyril Guimard as well.
Oh, yeah, Cyril Guimard. So because there are three distinct parts, really, to the course, he said it was going to be in that very French Guimard way. He said it was going to be like trying to digest a very rich three-course meal. I think it's going to be a little bit more unpleasant than that, and that's speaking as someone who has a lot of trouble digesting at the moment, but I'd still rather be digesting food than this race.
Cyril Guimard came back to coach the French team last year. I mean, he's not been involved in this level of cycling for years, but he's a legendary DS who masterminded three different riders to Tour de France victories. Lucien Van Impe, Bernard Hinault, and Laurent Fignon, one of the great figures of cycling. And it's quite surreal to see him back. And we were at the French Hotel Friday night for their press conference or their media gathering. And Guy Mar was there holding court. I also encountered him a little bit later in the hotel where he was very friendly towards me. And we were just observing Julian Alaphilippe.
Can we say, was it the urinals?
It was at the urinals. Yeah. And he said hello and... And I said, bon chance. And it occurred to me, I was meaning for the race, but
and
it occurred
thought,
to me.
Thought, yeah, that you
not a young
thought
man.
He had trouble getting it out.
Anyway, moving on, we were watching Julian Alaphilippe, weren't we? And for a lot of people, he's a big favourite today. Our French colleagues who are staying in our hotel from L'Equipe were saying that, you know, this is his year. Everything is made for him with the climb and the descent in particular.
Yeah, and everyone's talking up, quite rightly, Julian Alaphilippe's chances on this course. It's 20-odd years, isn't it, since we've had a French world champion. But I spoke to Thibaut Pinot at that media gathering, and he said that there wasn't necessarily a set leadership for the French and that it would be decided on the road. I think he quite fancies his chances as well, given any kind of circumstances. But I reckon the others are probably backup options in case Alaphilippe doesn't have it in him today. But they've got such a strong team here and a really strong chance. Probably the best chance, I think actually Pino said that, you know, now or never was the way he phrased it. I mean, obviously it's never as drastic as that. But I guess for this current batch and for the foreseeable future, it's the best option they're going to have for a number of years.
I mean, already we see the French and the British teams taking responsibility, putting a man on the front just to keep that gap to a manageable distance and ensure that Conor Dunn doesn't become the new world champion.
Yeah, you just tweeted something, didn't you? You said if Conor Dunn, as I confidently predict, will go on to win the world championships today, you can forget about the Vuelta, you can forget about the Tour of Britain. The only preparation for the Worlds next year will be the no-go tour.
Larry Warbass will be much in demand.
Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa, without whom, etc., we wouldn't be here. Why are you laughing, Arla? What are you laughing at?
It just you said that with a bit of a flourish.
A flourish.
It's unlike you.
You
become very
hand.
European.
It's because I just met Ciro.
You gesticulated,
I'm full of hand movements. We're going to hear from Ciro a little bit later. But thank you very much indeed to Rafa. Fortunately, I don't go anywhere without a stock of Pédaleur and Pédaleuse de Charme t-shirts. Yesterday at the Women's Road Race, we presented a Pédaleuse de Charme t-shirt to Cecilie Uttrup-Ludwig. Today, I presented Pédaleuse de Charme to Conor Dunn. A lot of people have been asking for him to win a Pédaleuse de Charme t-shirt for his exploits in the no-go tour. And today in the men's road race, he was away in that break for a lot of the race, putting himself out there. So went and saw him, and we'll hear from him a little bit later in the episode. But Orla, we're coming back down from a really exhilarating men's road race, I thought. You know, we mentioned earlier that it was a slow burn and this gradual build-up and a cagey race. You know, I think it's a cliche, but it was a war of attrition. It was a gradual kind of selection over the whole distance. But at the back of everybody's mind was that climb, Hull. And they really did that pretty well in terms of presenting it with the graphics and the welcome to Hull. There wasn't a huge crowd up there. I think most people went to the main climb up Eagles to enjoy the race many times. And a lot of people not sure whether these super steep climbs belong in professional cycling. But today we saw an absolute humdinger. Alejandro Valverde is the world champion. He just beat Romain Bardet in the sprint with Michael Woods third. The outsider tipped by one or two people. Wink, wink. But a tremendous, tremendous performance by him on the type of climb that really suits him.
It was a thrilling race. I thoroughly enjoyed it, given that it was some 7 hours long. We mentioned at the opening of the podcast that Cyril Guimard, the French head coach, had described it, or what is his official title? He's not head coach, team manager, whatever
head
it is.
Coach.
Head coach. Had compared the race beforehand to a difficult to digest three-course French meal. Well, I think it was more of a four-course meal. We had the starters of the 11-man break.
Menu. 14,
it was a bit of a
taster
menu.
14-course taster menu.
Well, we had the start of the 11-man break. I think the main course came at about 60 kilometres to go when we had these series of attacks off the front. Didn't know which ones would stick. Greg Van Avermaet's move looked very strong. We had the likes of Theo Gegenhardt, Pete Kenyuk working really hard. The French working incredibly hard along with the Italians in that part of the race. Then, to stick with the French theme, we had the cheese course, which in France comes before dessert, of course. That was when Michael Valgren, I think, went off. And it really looked like he could have stayed away. A cheesy attack, an attack of the cheese. But we knew that Hüttinger Hill was coming as a dessert. And it was the yummiest dessert I could have ordered off the menu. It was brilliant. And like you say, it was just, it was attritional.
It was,
and it's used over and over again.
Very, very rich.
But one that you didn't want to finish.
No.
Like, even coming into the final kilometre, they were going under the Flamme Rouge. And we were both discussing earlier how we love long races, because when it's over, you feel a bit of a loss, because the anticipation isn't there anymore. You know who've won, it's done. And even in the last kilometre, I thought, oh, I'm really sad this is coming to an end. because even we were in the mix zone, and mix zones can be fairly dry places to watch a race compared to out by the finish line or in a fan zone or whatever it might be. And everyone was on edge as the riders were going up Hüttinger Hill, and the riders were being dropped one after the other after the other. And then we had the three lead riders together going over the top and down the other end. Then the camera pans back and Tom Dumoulin is still there. And he managed to make his way across. So we had the four of them towards the end. And then towards the end, we had a glimpse of Gianni Moscon, thinking, goodness, could he make it on? He didn't.
Well, he'd been one of the four, and he was just broken eventually by the climb. And really, Michael Woods put in an acceleration and got rid of Moscon. And, you know, that was a moment, because one minute there were four, and I think, you know, Moscon is a controversial figure, as is Valverde. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people were perhaps wouldn't have relished a Gianni Moscon victory here. But when it was just too much for him, he just went completely. And, you know, even when Dumoulin obviously came up behind and swept him up, he couldn't stay with him. And Dumoulin is such a difficult opponent, because we've seen this in countless races now, that he gets dropped, but he's not out of it. He's very, very good at managing his effort. And when he came back to those leading three on the streets of Innsbruck, racing in towards the finish, I thought he was going to go straight past them. Mm. You know, I thought that would have been a great tactic, but it would have been a great tactic, but
he didn't have the legs.
No.
He said it himself. He had no choice there. And you could tell when he caught them, the momentum should have propelled him forward, but he slowed down. And you could see from that he really didn't have it. But didn't that add to the whole drama of that finale as well? You say that Gianni Moscon wouldn't have been the most popular winner. Alejandro Valverde, unless you're Spanish, I mean, we saw a Spanish journalist in tears afterwards
that
with
was
delight.
Quite, that was quite odd.
Bizarre. But he's quite a divisive figure as well. And then you've got superhero Tom Dumoulin and the good guy Michael Woods. So you've got all of those dynamics going into the final as well. It was just thrilling, thrilling World Championships.
Yeah, let me just read a small extract from A Journey Through the Cycling Year, the book that we published this year. We will get on to Valverde soon, and it's worth saying that I think among his peers, he's a very popular winner, because I think he's, regardless of his history, he served a doping ban, of course. He was involved in Operation Puerto, and I think that sits very uncomfortably with a lot of people. But, you know, over a long period of time, because he's 38 now, he has proven to be, in an era when we think the sport is cleaner and certainly testing, if not perfect, is better, he has been one of the most consistent riders, and has won a lot of big races and gone very, very close to the world title before and just missed it. And this was the one he wanted. But at the Vuelta last year, when I was speaking to Michael Woods before the start of the race, and Alberto Contador was being presented to the crowd, he said to me, and this was an off-the-record conversation, but he said, you know, they talk about Spain's golden generation, Valverde, Contador, Sanchez. Valverde busted in Operation Puerto, Contador had a positive test, and now Sammy Sanchez. Golden generation, you know, I wish these guys would just disappear, is what he said. And I said it was an off-record conversation, but when I emailed him to ask him whether he would mind me including that line in the book, he replied, absolutely no problem. So come out with something quite strong there about how he felt about Valverde last year, and I think some people will share that sentiment. But there are an awful lot of riders, as I said, in the bunch who really respect Valverde for the rider he is, but also for the guy he is. He's a down-to-earth rider. There are no real airs and graces with him. He's very, you know, good with the media and so on. And he's in a lot of circles. He'll be a very, very popular winner indeed. Shall I run through the nuts and bolts of the race a little bit before we hear a bit of the reaction from the race?
Please do.
Well, I mean, we've got all the road races to catch up on. We've got an episode of the cycling podcast Femina coming out very soon, which will focus largely on the women's road race, of course. But we had the women's junior road race this week with Laura Steger, the Austrian winner, who appeared at the fan zone where we were for a lot of the race today. Orlan got a fantastic reception for people. That was only her second road race. Great talent, obviously. And it was a cracking race, that. Marie Lynette from France was second. Simone Boilard from Canada, third. So good World Championships for Canada. Mm. In the men's junior road race, well, Remco Evenepoel, the Belgian, what is he? Just a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, he crashed. He was off the back. He was down for quite some time, at least 2 minutes. He worked his way back through the stragglers, got back to the front and attacked and won the race by 1:25 ahead of Marius Meyerhofer from Germany, with Alessandro Fanciullo third. There were 3 Italians in the top 9 and 2 Americans in the top 10 as well in that race. It's always worth keeping an eye on that in the junior road race. That was quite surreal for me because I was at the CPA General Assembly, the Professional Riders Association meeting, just on a hill overlooking Innsbruck. And we were watching the junior road race on my computer when there was a break in proceedings, and Gianni Bugno, the president, and David Miller, the challenger, both came out of the room while the election was going on and both sat down and watched the race.
The three of you crowded around your computer, iPhone.
Well,
computer.
On my computer. And it was funny because Bugno and Miller have been having this kind of war of words in the press, and there they were, both sitting watching the junior road race together.
United by their love of the sport. How beautiful.
For once. Men's under 23 road race followed. Mark Hirschi of Switzerland, brilliant attack on the descent of the Eagles climb. They won him that race. He rides for Sunweb development team. That was a really well taken win. Bjorg Lambrecht, the Lotto Soudal rider, climber really from Belgium, he was second. Jaakko Hanninen from Finland was third. Fifth was Mark Padun, the Ukrainian who was out front a lot, but he rides for Barry Merida, and he won on that circuit at the Tour of the Alps back in, I think it was April. And so to Saturday, Orla, and the women's road race, which we did much the same as what we did today, which was we went up the climb, went up to the fan zone.
We took our city bikes up there,
and a little
didn't we?
Picnic
our little hired
stolen
bikes.
From the hotel yeah. breakfast buffet. Sandwiches wrapped in serviettes.
In napkins, yeah.
Fantastic.
Unnecessarily so, because we got to the top and realised that we could have actually just bought some Bratwurst mit Frit.
Which we did as well. Did anyway. Yeah, we didn't go hungry. But we watched that. Well, it was an interesting race. Pretty much as expected, a Dutch victory. A very dominant performance. And I said to you, Orla, today, you know, 40Ks to go in the men's race, there were still so many riders in it. But really, 40Ks to go in the women's race, it was all over. Anna van der Breggen hit the nuclear button. Annemiek van Vleuten had attacked. She'd crashed earlier. As she found out later, had broken a bone in her knee. Still finished seventh in the race. But she attacked. A few riders followed that attack. And then Anna van der Breggen went over the top, bridged up to the break, which included Amanda Spratt, one of the favourites for the race. Spratt stayed with van der Breggen a little bit, but got dropped on the climb. And then it was a time trial for both of them. And they came in first and second. Van der Breggen won by an astonishing 3:42, with Spratt second. And
time
Tatiana,
trial as well for Tatiana Guderzo of Italy.
Guderzo was third at 5:26. I mean, the time...
They were all so strung out.
The time gaps were amazing. Emilia Fallon was fourth. It was a surprising race in the sense that a lot of the riders that we fancied to see up there, we didn't really see. But a very worthy winner, obviously, in Anna van der Breggen. This is the one thing that's been missing for her. And she's a terrific talent. But it wasn't edge of the seat stuff for the last hour of the race, because it looked like she had it sewn up. And what's amazing is that since Rio 2 years ago, she won the Olympic road race there, of course. You know, she was away in a group there with Emma Johansson and Elisa Longo-Borghini after countering a move also by Annemiek van Vleuten, who crashed on that occasion. But the strides that those two have made, Van der Breggen and Van Vleuten, have been extraordinary the last couple of years. They are on a different level. Those two, I mean, the Dutch team is strong, but those two in particular are just performing, as I say, at a different level to everybody else. And, you know, I'm not really sure how that's happened because, as I say, a couple of years ago, someone like Longo-Borghini was able to follow a move by Van der Breggen. And I don't know what those other riders are going to do to try and close that gap, because there is a gap there.
There's a very significant gap. And I mean, the course in Rio was obviously very different, and it finished with the descent off the major climb up to Vista Chiesa and then the flat into Copacabana Beach. So the end of this race was an awful lot tougher. We expected more from it. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see the dominance of those two riders, but they do strike us as being the riders who've taken the professionalism and the move into professionalism of the sport that bit more seriously. You know, Van Vleuten goes off and does her training camps at altitude and in the way that the men do. Van der Breggen as well took a different approach to this year's Worlds. To almost everyone else, really, all of her other competitors. She took a lot of the season of racing off, did an awful lot more specific training for the World Championships. And they have been allowed to do that by their teams. Not all top riders can afford to do that. You know, if you look at Ashley Milman-Passio, for example, she's been team leader for the last year or so. And for her to be able to just concentrate on the Worlds when her chances are not as obvious perhaps as Anna van der Breggen or Annemiek van Vleuten is much more difficult. So I think it's a combination of a few different things, really, but they've certainly been able to make the most of the professionalism of the sport in a number of different ways, and at the moment it looks like it's going to take a while for anyone else to get up to their level. And that's mercifully not to say that neither of them can be beaten, because they've both been beaten this season. But when they win, they show such a display of prowess that it puts everyone else in the shade, really.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
May I say, Richard, you're looking remarkably smooth. Are you sort of struck by the youthfulness of the male peloton and trying to keep up with their boyish ways and having as close a shave as possible by any chance?
Well, you may say that, Orla. Yeah, thank you very much. Very kind of you. We heard the voice of Seb Pika there, which reminded Orla to set up beautifully.
But it's true. You are looking very clean shaven today.
I am. Yeah, yeah. I did have a shave with my Harry's razor this morning. There was a degree of spontaneity to that, actually. Mm. Doesn't sound like it, but there was. Yes, thank you very much to the episode sponsor, Harry's Razors. Harry's Razors, of course, include everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip, and a trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover.
I tell you what, we might be bumping into Fran Reyes later, and I want to ask him if he's been using his Harry's razor, because he was up on the top table of the press conference earlier doing a translation for Alejandro Valverde, and his sideburns were looking on point. That boy's face was like a newborn baby's bum.
Valverde maybe been using the Harry's razor on his head as well.
Maybe he needs to, bless him. Just get rid of it. I just thought, come on,
yeah, get
Alejandro,
it, get
give
it.
Up the ghost.
Yeah, a close shave. He needs a close shave, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does need a close shave.
Well, Alejandro,
he needs it.
Alejandro, if you're listening and if you have an address in the UK, you can get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for just £3.95. Support the cycling podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, which includes the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and the travel blade cover, by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling. Well, Orla, before the interval there, you were talking about the women's race. And as I said, we've got an awful lot of reaction and interviews from the women's race coming in the next Cycling Podcast Femina, which will be out in 1 week, including a sort of bit of live reportage from us over the course of the day. But we have a couple of interviews from it. First of all, Lucy Kennedy, the Australian rider who's got an interesting backstory. Her first year with Mitchelton Scott this year. And she rode a really good race. She's a good climber and did a great job for Amanda Spratt. I spoke to her at the finish. And Orla, you spoke to Lucinda Brand, the Dutch rider, teammate of the winner, Anna van der Breggen, and she was up there in the top 10 as well, wasn't she?
She was, yeah, and she rode a great race. I'm a big fan of Lucinda Brand,
ninth.
Actually.
She was nice.
She's so consistent. She's so strong. And she's always up there in the decisive moves. Yeah, I mean, there were four Dutch riders in the top nine yesterday, so not a surprise that she was one of them. And I wanted to get a little bit of an insight into the Dutch camp, really, because they had these two very strong leaders. They messed that up quite spectacularly at the European Championships, and she was talking a little bit about the lessons learned from there. So, yeah, let's have a little listen to Lucy Kennedy.
Lucy
and
Kennedy
Lucinda
and then
Brand.
Lucinda Brand. Well, I mean, Amanda Spratt second. I don't suppose she could have done much more. She rode a good race and put herself in a really good position, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, we were coming here to win, but, you know, second's an amazing result. You know, I guess that Van der Breggen was just stronger on the day. But, yeah, that move she got away in wasn't quite the plan. It was a bit earlier than we expected, but yeah, it was a really good move for her and put us in a really good position.
Well, you were obviously busy at the front. We saw a lot of you today. Are you happy with how you rode today?
Yeah, I mean, that was my job, to particularly that first climb, just to get on the front and ride the whole thing as hard as I could. And I think that, yeah, I did that, and that I think that really worked well to set Spratty up, because it meant that no one else was. Kind of everyone was a little bit under the pump, so it allowed her to get away when everyone was hurting a bit.
And I think when the Dutch launched their move, Annemiek van Vleuten had a go, you were on her wheel at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, that second lap, I was the only other Aussie there in that bunch that was left, and I knew that the Dutch were going to start firing attacks, so I was going with as much as I could. But yeah, I covered Annemiek one time, but yeah, when Anna launched her big one, I just couldn't go with it, so unfortunately she got away.
And clearly nobody could go with it.
No.
I mean, the two of them are on a different level, aren't they? Today was extraordinary. I think she won by about 3 minutes 42 in the end.
Yeah, that's really, really impressive riding.
Congratulations, Lucinda, on an incredible team ride. We all knew that the Dutch were going to be the team to beat, but that was quite something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not something you just do. Also, not when you have the strong riders in your team, it's still super hard to also do it in the end. And yeah, so we're super proud, of course, on the whole team, how everybody reached their level and put the energy into this win. Yeah.
There was a lot of speculation before the race. I think it's fair to say that with so many strong riders, would there be cohesion within the team? Was there ever any danger of you guys not pulling together and working together? Did it always feel like a team on the inside?
Yeah, it was always like a team. In the last year, of course, we had some comments over us that we were another team after Europeans. It looked like that. I think it was also it's just the danger of being such a strong team. So that's the thing where we have spoken about how we could manage that better, to not come in strange situations, and that we have no overview anymore. So yeah, that worked much better today.
So you learned lessons as a team then from the Europeans?
Yeah, of course. I think not only from Europeans, I think you learn from every race you do. It doesn't matter if it's from your own team or from a country. And then you speak together how you can get the strongest out of each other and be a strong collective. And of course it's not easy, especially not when you have two favorites in your team. And of course more people want to have the best result. But yeah, we really spoke well about it. And if one should go, the other should wait till the concurrent should go, and the opposite. And as far as I could see, we did it like that, and then we can all be very proud about this success.
So now that the race has been won, can you tell us what the team tactics were before the race? Did you have specific orders as to whether it was Annemiek or Anna that the team were behind?
No, it was neither one or the other one. It was always both, like do it together and help each other on getting the rest of the field tired. And of course it was first up to the other riders to get them tired, to get the front, to get another team chasing. Like Australia had to work already in the beginning when Ella was in the front, and those kind of situations were super good. And we, of course, you always speak about the ideal situation up front, and it's never ideal. So we had already the crash with Annemiek. Yeah, you cannot, of course, you think it's possible that something happens, but yeah, you never speak about it, that clear. And yeah, we did said like, yeah, it, of course, it depends on how the race is going, but probably we will make the hard race hard the second climb. And yeah, we kept that plan, and it worked out good. So.
So four Dutch riders in the top 10 dominated the individual time trial podium. How much more is to come from this generation of Dutch female riders?
I hope a lot, and I hope it never ends. It should be great. I think we always have a lot of strong riders in the Netherlands, and I hope also after this generation there will come more talent again. Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our long-time supporters and sponsors, and they're still offering 25% off to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast. If you go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25, that's SISCP25, you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products. And thank you very much again to them. It's thanks to them and our other sponsors that we're here at the World Championships. And since we are here, we're going to put out a couple of bonus episodes this coming week. Kilometer Zero, World Shorts, what we'd call them, something like that. One, well, they're both very interesting and certainly off the beaten track. Can you tell us a bit about them, Orla, because you did both interviews?
Yes, we spotted a rider on our arrival, actually, just as we'd landed. The men's time trial had finished. We spotted a rider in a Syrian kit and thought, there might be a story behind that.
Might be.
So went over and introduced ourselves. Badreddin Weiss was a gentleman. And he did have a very interesting story, actually. Shall I give a little bit of a tease? He... rides here, he's the only elite man riding from Syria, fled Aleppo, his home city of Aleppo, a few years ago when the war broke out. So fascinating to chat to him about his story and also what cycling has done for him through his journey. And the other rider is someone who's become my new girl crush, Edwige Pitel, the French woman who at the age of 51 was the oldest rider at these World Championships, and she's been the oldest rider for the last couple of years, really. Remarkably, was French national champion 2 years ago at the age of 49. And as she pointed out, she's had a normal length of career. She's been in cycling for 15 years. It's just that she started her career when most other riders are considering retirement. She didn't get into cycling until the age of 36. So as well as getting a bit of her story, I tried to get a few tips just in case I decide to do an Edwige and hit the pro scene once I pop the second baby out.
Watch the space. Let's get into the meat of the men's race a little bit and then get some of the reaction. Yeah, exactly. The schnitzel. because there was a lot going on, obviously. A lot of favourites, a lot of fancied riders. Alaphilippe was perhaps the main favourite, but one of many. And he lost a teammate, Warren Barguil, with a crash with about 100 kilometres to go. Not long after that, Peter Sagan was in trouble, defending champion, three-time world champion. Not looked in the best of form since the Tour de France and his bad crash towards the end of the Tour de France. Struggled through the Vuelta. He was out. So he wasn't going to defend his jersey, as some people thought he had an outside chance of doing. We started to see quite a lot of aggression from the Italians at that point. They had a full complement of riders up there with 200 kilometers in their legs. They were quite prominent at the front. We saw David Cataldo go up the road with Jesus Herrada. Vincenzo Nibali as well followed that move, and Michał Kwiatkowski from Poland, former world champion, was pretty prominent too. But there was a counter move behind with Greg Van Avermaet was the next move that went, with Damiano Caruso and Omar Fraile. Again, Italy and Spain represented there. And that was a pretty dangerous looking move, actually. I mean, Omar Fraile, another guy who you would say was an outsider. there was another crash, this one taking out an outsider, or a fancied outsider, Primoz Roglic. He crashed with Ben King and had a long chase to get back on, but did eventually get back on. But I saw him at the finish, and you know, it was obviously quite a heavy crash. He had a lot of skin off his shoulder. Dan Martin was the next rider who we sort of fancied for this race to fall out of contention. Wout Poels, then, very surprisingly, Kwiatkowski got dropped as well. Simon Yates was the next one, the recent Vuelta winner, who pretty much rode at the back the whole race, and it just wasn't his day, so he was out of it. Up front, his teammate, Peter Kenyuk, someone we've not seen at this level for a while, he was very active, and he had a couple of goes. He was joined by the likes of Michael Valgren, Rui Costa, Gianni Moscon, Thibaut Pinot was marking this move as well, another fancied rider. And Roglic was right back up there too. Valgren was the guy that took the initiative on the way, you know, after they finished all the climbs of Eagles, and still a big group there in contention. It was Michael Valgren that got away, winner of Het Nieuwsblad earlier this year, a really, really strong, very, very underrated rider. And he had a good 30-second gap leading into this horrific climb. Hull, welcome to Hull, not Hull.
Not Hull.
Hull.
Hurtinger Hull.
Hull.
Yeah, he sort of jumped off at Pete Kenyuk's move. Kenyuk went first.
Yeah, it was a very strong move, actually. And in fact, Valgren rode an excellent race and finished seventh in the end. Mm. So a really, really strong performance from him. But it was going up the climb. Good job by the Spanish. Jon Izaguirre was there helping to set up Alejandro Valverde, and these four emerged at the front. Surprised to see Alaphilippe fall out of contention at this point. He got dropped, and so it was Bardet, Michael Woods, Alejandro Valverde, and Gianni Moscon. And those four raced away on the ascent of Hull, which was, again, like some of the climbs we've seen in the Vuelta, where it's like a tortoise race. And when we saw Didi the Devil running behind them, we realised just how slowly they were going. Because it's so steep. And as Michael Woods explained in his press conference, he loves climbs where he's out of the saddle and the action is more like running, which is what he used to be good at. And he explained, actually, it was interesting, because he explained the more sort of crouched up, folded up he is, the less efficient he is as an athlete. Because
makes a lot of sense,
he thinks,
really.
It's his running background, that he wants to be upright. And on a steep climb like that, you're out of the saddle a lot, and it just suits him. And we saw him win a stage on a climb like that at the Vuelta, and here he was performing in this, you know, at a level. I mean, we saw him up there in Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year, but he's got a really solid set of results this year. Podium at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, stage win at Vuelta, and bronze medal here. And he's had a lot of setbacks this year as well. So phenomenal, really, by Michael Woods. And the surprise, but also not really a surprise. Moscon was broken near the top of the climb. It was Woods, really, that was putting on a bit of pressure. We saw Bardet drop back a little bit. He seemed to have a little problem with his bike. I think you spoke to him at the finish, Orla. What happened?
He was trying to get into the big ring and just messed it up, basically. He said it was his fault. He mistimed it. It didn't slow him down too much. He was fiddling with his bike a little bit, but seemed to get it sorted, and I didn't think it really hampered him in any way. But you're talking about the steepness of the climb, and it's worth pointing out that while those three were riding off the front, Tom Dumoulin was zigzagging across the road. He looked like he was not going to make it to the front of that climb with any real dignity intact, never mind managing to get up and then onto the back again. Phenomenal.
It was amazing. And Dumoulin, as I said earlier, such a difficult opponent. But over the top of the climb, it was those three together. And we were told, and I hadn't seen it, but we were told it was a very technical descent with only helicopter shots at that point. It looked fairly controlled. And I thought, I mean, Bardet is an excellent descender. We've seen him win stage at the Tour de France thanks to his skill on the descent. Valverde is a brilliant descender as well. And I wondered if Michael Woods might have a problem there, but he didn't, so that was good. But the three of them obviously came back into Innsbruck and were joined by Dumoulin, as I said earlier, and those four contested the finish. And Valverde led it out for the last kilometre and won the sprint, as you would expect him to, really, in that company. He is the second oldest world champion in history after Joep Zoetemelk in 1985. He was 38 years, 8 months and 29 days. Alejandro Valverde's 38 with 5 months and 5 days. And he was joined on the podium by his children. One of his daughter was shouting, "Papa," in the press conference as well. They came in there. Not sure they were accredited. Should they have been in there, Orla?
And should have pointed that out.
Peter Sagan presented him with his gold medal on the podium. Tom Dumoulin was fourth. Gianni Moscon was fifth. Roman Kreuziger was sixth. Michael Valgren, as I said, was seventh. Julian Alaphilippe, a disappointed eighth. Thibaut Pinot, ninth. Rui Costa, tenth. Former world champion. Best ride we've seen from him for a number of years, I would say. Yoni Zagiri, 11th. Balcom Mollema, 12th. Mikel Nievi, 13th. As you said earlier, Orla, it was the trick today was to hide, to hide,
Verstecken,
to hide.
Verstecken, Verstecken.
Exactly. And you know, we didn't see a lot of these guys until we needed to see them.
Yeah, we saw a lot of France and Italy on the front for quite a long time, and they looked very threatening indeed. Spanish team, not quite so much, though, I thought. I mean, they did a brilliant job, but they weren't so obvious, I thought, for as much of the race. But again, that was probably very deliberate and stood them in very good stead.
Frehley was up there. I thought he was their sort of wild card. You know, if one of those moves had got away, he was a dangerous rider, a guy who's very good at winning. So we hear from Yoni Zagiri, Barry Morita rider, who is Alejandro Valverde's teammate. Orla, you've got your hand up.
I do, because I need to just make a very small correction. Because when you said we were going into the meat of the race, I said Die Fleisch, and it's obviously Das Fleisch, and it's been bothering me ever since. So there we go. That's my autocorrect.
Live corrections corner. Here's what Ion Izaguirre, Alejandro Valverde's Spanish teammate, had to say at the finish.
How does it feel to have helped Alejandro finally win the world title?
It's an amazing feeling, you know. It's a special race, world championship. We know that we can win today with Alejandro, but you know, it's a wonder race, and everything can happen. But finally he won one world championship, and I think that he closed a circle, a cycle.
Did everything go right on the day? Were there any moments in the race where you were worried or concerned, or was it pretty much a perfect race for Spain?
Yes, I think that we do all of our best to keep Alejandro in the best position to save energy, and we stay in the front with closing the gaps with big national teams like Italy, France, Gran Bretagne, Belgium, and all that selection. And in the last climb, we arrive all together, all the big riders, and in the end, he arrived with the best riders, and their sprint he won. No?
So that was Yoni Zagiri. Orla, you spoke to Romain Bardet, the silver medalist. Shall we hear from him?
Yeah, we had a very quick word with him. He was very much in demand, but we got a few questions with him just at the end of the race.
Comment, félicitations. You came into this race, the French team, with three possible leaders. Thibaut put in an amazing effort. You and Julien stayed together until the final climb. How does it feel to take, not the gold, but a medal back to France?
Yeah, medal back. Yeah, it's a good point for us. Yeah, we worked very well together. The timing was just perfect. The lead out was also perfect. So yeah, we are happy. I'm really happy. It's the medal for the team, and it's good for us.
So that was Romain Bardet. Well, let's hear another interview, since we've got all these interviews lined up, and some of them are
why not
have quite interesting things to say. I think you spoke to friend of the podcast, Peter Kenyuk.
I did speak to Peter
Kenyuk. Broke his silence.
Stop this. I think it's only with you that he's silent. I've always, always find him lovely. And he rode such a strong race today. And in fact, he finished 16th, which was the top British finish. Not a great world championship for the Brits overall. But
No, one bronze medal, isn't it?
Yeah, one bronze medal. But for Pete Kenyuk, that was his third best finish all year. So to do that in a world championships, and not just any old world championships, but one of the toughest in years, was a remarkable feat, I thought. And he was broken, but I think quite happy, quite content with his performance at the end of the race.
Pete, phenomenal race. I mean, that was just incredible how you rode that. How did it feel?
Yeah, it was quite, it was hard all day actually. Like I just said, for race cycling, it's quite, without radios, it's quite hard to always speak to your teammate to find out how everyone is. So yeah, I had a little attack with two laps to go on the climb, but in hindsight I should have waited really, but I didn't know for instance, that Simon wasn't feeling good, so I was kind of just sticking to the plan we had before the race to, yeah, make it hard. But I mean, that was just a brutal race from start to finish. That's what I meant. And yeah, Valverde finally gets his jersey, so yeah, congrats to him, I guess.
You spent a good 30k at the front or near the front from about 60 kilometres to go before even that final dig that you made. Was that the plan, just to make it as hard as possible?
Yeah, from the start we kind of like split up into sections. We had Stannard and Connor for the first part, and then between Teo, Noxy and Hugh to speak to themselves to make it hard with kind of three to go, and obviously me and Adam towards the back end. So yeah, I was just trying to be around the front, like I said about radios, it's difficult, so it kind of means you've got to be a bit more vigilant. So yeah, now I feel sick.
You must be happy with your ride all the same though.
Yeah.
Well, Peter Kenny, very generous of him to speak to the Cycling Podcast again.
Stop
after
it.
Boycotting it for the last couple of years.
You've just been mean to him.
No, I asked him for an interview at the Vuelta, and he said he didn't speak to podcasts. Did he know he was speaking to the Cycling Podcast and he was speaking to you?
Well, I don't know. He was just speaking to me, wasn't he?
Anyway, it's fine. Anyway. It's all fine. George Bennett, I spoke to him as well, the New Zealander. He was pretty prominent, actually, quite noticeable in his black New Zealand kit. And he was 18th in the end. Here's what he had to say at the finish.
How did it go in the end?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a bit of a horrible old day out there, eh? It was it was super hard, but not as selective as I thought, because the climb was just not that steep. But we still went really hard, and just a lot of guys could still get over, and just made it an absolute shit fight.
It was a very, very gradual wearing down process, wasn't it? Did you find it quite a cagey race? It seems a ridiculous thing to say on such a hard circuit, but did it feel like quite a cagey race?
Yeah, obviously the start, they let it go out to 18 minutes, and I was thinking, oh, maybe we'll see the breakaway win, but I guess it was such a hard course, and guys, you know, it happened at the back of the race as opposed to going off the front, but there was definitely moments you could be... I started looking at the situation, not a lot of guys had teammates left, and there was one move I jumped in and it had a Dutch guy, a Frenchie, a Spanish, a British, and I thought this could really be a good move. But the Spanish were super committed and obviously worked out for them. So.
And how was it on that final climb?
Oh, mate, that was filthy. You know, guys are cramping up, stopping in front of me. I nearly came off. I did come off. I had to unclip and then clip back in. It was like junior racing on a... It was crazy because, I mean, everyone was just so rooted that... Yeah, I guess they were cramping up or whatever, and it was, I don't know, just it was bloody steep. It was as hard as, it was one of those climbs that was actually as hard as it's been hyped up to be, you know. Normally they hype it up too much, but I think this was genuinely hard.
And Alejandro Valverde, world champion at last, what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I guess long time coming. I mean, he's been a dominant, you know, for me he's a... the rider of the year, you know, when you look back to the spring, and I mean obviously he had a shit tour, but I guess if you're 38 years is riding your bike at,
you've got a few years ahead of you, eh?
Yeah, if I can go that long, it'd be nice to grab one of them one day.
Oh, they're coming thick and fast, Orla. That was George Bennett. Who have you got next for us?
It's like a game show. Next up, we've got contestant number 4, Tom Dumoulin, who, as he pointed out, had his best ever finish at a World Championships, but he couldn't be too disappointed. You noticed on the time trial that his shorts looked like they were flapping slightly when he was standing
on
the podium.
He looks like
he's lost weight. He's so skinny, yeah. So lean. So he was obviously going for this to a certain extent. Well, yeah. I mean, he's going for it, wasn't he? He's at the World Championships. Anyway, here's Tom Dumoulin.
Phenomenal effort, especially towards the end. Talk us through that chase to get back on the leading three.
I knew that I had a chance to come back if they would look a little bit to each other. But I wouldn't. I knew that it would also cost me a lot of energy, and it did. It proved to be too much eventually to be on the podium. But it's a good result, but not... if you're fourth out of four, that's not really what you're hoping for if you go to the finish like that.
When you're coming into the finish, did you think you had enough in your legs to be able to contest the sprint, or you knew it was over?
I had nothing left.
Good race all the same, happy with it?
Yeah, definitely. It's my best one-day race that I did so far. So it proved that I'm getting better also at this. I hope to get even better in the future.
And everyone was talking before the race just about how tough the course was going to be. Was it as bad, as hard as expected?
Yeah, it was, yeah. 11 strong riders in the front with 18 minutes. So, yeah, we went pretty fast to catch them back. And I think everybody was on that limit. But that's racing.
That was Tom Dumoulin. Just such a, an amazing season, really. Second at the Giro, second at the Tour de France, fourth at the World Championship Road Race, second in the World Championship Time Trial. And I wonder if when he goes and reflects on the season and plans for next season, he'll have a little bit more of a targeted approach, one race, which you would think would be the Tour de France. But what a consistent rider. And on a course like this, which really looked like a climber's course, he's been the equal of the best climbers in the world.
He's just a shadow rider, isn't he? You just cannot shake him. Riders just cannot get away from him. And also worth noting that he hadn't actually recce'd the course until this week. He said at the press conference after the time trial he hadn't done it yet. He'd planned to do it the next day, but he'd cramped during the time trial, so he was giving himself a rest. So he said maybe Friday was the first day that he would actually get on the course, compared to others who've been to Innsbruck throughout the season to target these World Championships. It was a remarkable performance from him.
Speaking of shadows, Orla, Nibali's shadow. In a very rowdy Innsbruck, in the centre of Innsbruck, there are Dutch fans singing all kinds of songs behind us, but we've been joined by the one and only, the only Italian in town, Ciro Scognamiglio.
Ciao listeners, it's a pleasure to stay with you. You know, here in Innsbruck, Austria, not my favorite landscape, dear Richard, dear listeners, not my ideal scenario for a world, but we are here.
We are here, Ciro, and we were all glued to the screen watching the finale of the race. Gianni Moscon there. I mean, Nibali made his move a little bit earlier, so maybe he didn't have the legs today, but Moscon, when he was in that group, were you thinking he could become world champion?
Well, not really, because he was in a certain way in the final with Valverde, and for sure for me it would have been difficult then he can drop Valverde, and certainly Valverde is better than him in the sprint. So not really, but in any case his performance in my opinion has been very good. We have to remember that after the Tour he rode only 4 races to arrive here at the Worlds, no Vuelta, only 4 one-day races. And so with only 24, a fifth place in the world, last year 13 in the Lombardy, 15 in Paris-Roubaix, maybe he could be the next big thing for Italian cycling.
And Nibali, has he not really recovered from his crash at the Tour?
Not really, not. He's in the best shape. Maybe in 2 weeks for the Lombardy, maybe in my opinion he will be in better shape. I mean, certainly he recovers a little bit comparing with Vuelta, but certainly he was not at 100%. Certainly with his shape of last year in the end, when he won his second Lombardy, maybe the story could have been a little bit different.
Look who it is, Ciro. It's Orla.
The brightest star of our sky is correct in English, this phrase. Yeah, the brightest star of our sky, I can confirm.
You perked up since Orla arrived. Have you enjoyed your week in Innsbruck? I know that this is not your ideal environment. And tell me something because you were terrified of having to maybe go on a pre-Worlds training camp with Nibali. Did that happen?
No, fortunately no. No, fortunately not, listeners. I mean, this week has been very difficult for me. And maybe I am more tired now than the shark in itself. Because, he loves his landscape. And we have also to consider that. Imagine the luck of a guy as Gianni Moscon. His new apartment, his house, is 3 km from where we are talking now. Listeners, you have to remember that tomorrow morning I have to cover 500 km by car. And you know, I'm not really a driver, really, listeners. So you can imagine my feelings now.
Moscon, I understood he moved here to train for the Worlds. Is he going to stay here now?
Exactly, exactly. It's new town of residence, I mean. And now he lives in Innsbruck. I have to say...
This is weird. He only moved to Monaco quite recently.
Yeah, but he changed. Because he doesn't feel well in Monaco. And so here it's a little bit... near to his hometown, because it's only 2 hours. But when I had an interview with him 3 weeks ago, I speak in a very clear way to Gianni. Gianni, don't move to Innsbruck. Why? My friend Gianni, such a town. Nothing against Innsbruck. People are lovely also, but... it's not the right place in a state with no access to the sea. Austria, nothing against Austrian, but not my place.
So you're heading home tomorrow, Ciro?
Exactly, listeners, only 2 weeks. This season has been very long, but only 2 weeks left. And then in the off season, I don't know if it's possible to say, but we have something special for you.
Well, we're looking November. You're coming over to London to appear at our Clapham show.
My only reason to reach London, you, dear listeners. And, you know, Orla, I think can easily understand. It's also a pleasure to see her, a great pleasure. Richard, also you, Daniel, Lyle, all of you, but more of you, our listeners.
Well, safe home, Ciro.
Ciao, keep in touch, and see you soon.
See you soon. Well, from one friend of the cycling podcast to another, Fran Reyes. We've been joined by Fran. How are you, Fran?
I'm great, Rich. This has probably been one of the most exciting days of my life and the most exciting of the cycling season, definitely.
Well, you had an important job to do in the press conference because you were called in to translate for Alejandro Valverde, the new world champion. What did he have to say? I mean, we spoke a lot about him at the Vuelta and his big goal of winning the world championship, and how, you know, we wondered whether his efforts at the Vuelta, I can't even remember where he finished now. Was he second in the end or third? Oh, I can't remember. He was fifth.
He was
oh my goodness.
Fourth or fifth. I can't remember either, you know, but it's very interesting because we have been discussing all world along, why didn't he ease up, you know, and let the race go in order to better prepare for the Worlds, yet he came here and was in control of the race the whole time. You know, he seemed like the strongest rider on the race. So all the speculation, every discussion we had about that was
meaningless. I just had a total blank there. Of course, Enric Mas and Miguel Angel Lopez finished second and third, and Valverde cracked really quite badly the last 2 days at the Vuelta and looked really to have run out of gas completely. And we saw today the toll that the Vuelta took on Simon Yates, who was really never in the race, and actually Adam Yates as well. Pretty disappointing performance from those two riders, who certainly, you know, the course looked like it suited them. But Valverde has recovered, obviously, from his Vuelta efforts. And, well, oh, our beer has arrived.
Oh, that's good. Gross beer.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Cheers, Fran.
Cheers, Rich.
So, Valverde, this was the one that was missing for him, wasn't it? He's gone so close before, and, well, he can retire now, can't he?
Well, he was asked the other day whether he would retire if he got the rainbow jersey. His answer was no way. You know, he needs to showcase it for the next season, and he will keep on riding until Tokyo. But I guess that his career now enters in a completely different level. You know, he has attained all the goals he had in his career, but for the Tour de France victory, which proved to be out of his reach, but he still stood on the podium. That was a remarkable feat and one that satisfied him. So from here on, it's just extra time for him, extra time to enjoy.
I don't imagine, I mean, the things that we worry about when there's a new world champion is how far are they going to go and start blinging themselves up? He's not going to go for white shorts, is he? He's not going to go, he's going to keep it fairly sober. We want obviously the white rainbow jersey, but minimal other accoutrements. I mean, imagine if, you know, imagine Adam Blythe won the world championship.
Oh,
imagine,
come on, that would be brilliant.
Imagine if he won the rainbow jersey.
I'd love it.
You know, Cipollini.
Cipollini
style.
Have a bit of bling every now and again.
Is Valverde going to bling it up? I think
Blythe
he's going to be pretty
for world champion for that reason alone.
Well, back in the day when Rui Costa was crowned world champion, he was still racing for Movistar 2013. And he sported white jersey and white bib shorts. To be honest, I don't think that's the most comfortable or even good-looking option. I would go for a black shorts with white logos, but that's only my opinion. I would tell Alejandro, but I don't.
Keep it simple, Alejandro. Keep it simple. So Arla, there was at least somebody who tipped Michael Woods as an outsider for this race, wasn't there?
You've already mentioned it,
and you
left that hanging in the air.
Remind me who that was.
And I thought, we got away with it without you bigging yourself up.
First time it's ever happened.
I think
first
I said to you, listen, here's a little tip.
Happened.
You can say this in the podcast and sound like you know what you're talking about. Yeah, it was you, Richard.
Thanks for that. Well,
but only because you spoke to Michael Woods and he tipped himself.
Well, not only because of that, because he is kind of uniquely suited to these super, super steep climbs. And I thought today was excellent, and I thought it was a great addition because, you know, the riders were on the circuit, six laps of the circuit with the Eagles climb, and it falls into a pattern. They know the course very well. This was just an extra dimension to it where after that final climb of the Eagles climb, you just didn't know what was going to happen there. And even the riders were intrigued. We spoke to Dan Martin at the finish, and he was asking whether there were going to be fans up there. And, you know, a lot of riders were just very nervous about it and unsure about what was going to happen. But we saw, as we've said numerous times now, a great race. And the guy who excelled up there was Michael Woods. And I grabbed a word with him just after the press conferences. We were sneaking out through the corridors. Here's what he had to say.
I bumped into you in Girona a couple of weeks ago. You were confident. You said that you considered yourself one of the sort of second tier favourites for this race.
Yeah, I had a really nice kind of 2 weeks between the Vuelta and here. My family was in town. You saw me riding with my dad. I really appreciate being able to ride with my dad. And we had a nice week of riding together and just chilled out. But because we did such a crazy amount of volume in a Grand Tour, you realize you don't have to do much training in that time between. Just stay confident.
What did you think? What were you feeling going up? And as it whittled down, there were four of you, there were five of you, or four of you, then just three of you. What were you thinking then? And was it just a case of survival at that point? Or were you thinking, kind of maybe get rid of these guys?
Yeah, I tried to get rid of them. I feel like on a climb like that, the draft's irrelevant. So the best thing to do is just go as hard as you can and dictate the pace, as opposed to have the pace dictated for you. It's mentally devastating when you're just sitting behind other guys and they're going almost full gas for you, but you think, oh man, I'm suffering here, and you don't draw that like excitement. Whereas when you're on the front, people are yelling, and you look back and guys have dropped. You get that rush of adrenaline, and I really tried to channel that today.
Has it begun to sink in yet that you've won a bronze medal in the World Road Race Championship?
When I first crossed the line, I was kind of disappointed because I felt like I really could come around Valverde, but then cramped super hard and cramped in my calves, cramped in my hamstrings, and I really, like, literally almost couldn't turn the pedals over. So I was just disappointed, but I can't be disappointed. Like, sitting here now, like, I'm doing these crazy press conferences. Going up on the stage, there were still thousands of people watching, and then I saw my dad, saw my mom. My mom was crying. Give a big kiss to my wife. Couldn't be disappointed with that. It was pretty special.
So that was Michael Woods, and we really should start wrapping up from Innsbruck. We have, as I said earlier...
Do we have to? It's been brilliant.
Got these other episodes, these bonus Kilometre Zeros coming this week. Lots of other exciting things coming as well. We've got our event at the Wimbledon Book Festival.
Our sellout event.
On Friday. And then our event, and Fran will be joining us, I think, Fran and Clapham at the Clapham Grand on November the 12th.
With our mystery guest.
November the 27th as well, we're doing an event at in Cardiff at St David's Hall. Tickets still available for that. I think tickets are paused at the moment for Clapham because we've got to work out whether we can fit more people in. It's very close to being sold out. I think more tickets will go on sale very soon, so look out for that. Keep an eye on that. You'll see details at thecyclingpodcast.com if you go to live events. Now, speaking of the cycling podcast, as we have been, our recent friends special was Conor Dunn's Diary of the No-Go Tour with Larry Warbass. And it's had perhaps the best response we've ever had to a friend special. It's an hour and a half long, and it is a roller coaster of emotions. It's got highs, lows, and it ends wonderfully, I think. And I thoroughly enjoyed listening to it. Conor Dunn, of course, was in the breakaway today, as he tends to be. And we found him at the finish. Well, we actually, he was on his way. The Irish team were leaving the car park.
And, we stood.
We tried to get there in time. Didn't quite make it, but he got out the van.
Well, we stood in front of the van. We stopped it in its tracks.
He stranded himself. Yeah. In order to receive the Pedlar de Charme t-shirt that we feel he deserved. So here's Conor Dunn at the finish today.
Yeah, I mean, did you enjoy that out there?
Yeah, it was mega day, actually. Yeah, really enjoyed it. It's just nice to go out on my own terms, you know. Been a tough month. So, yeah, just nice to...
A lot of support for you out there as well.
Yeah, it was incredible support. Yeah, unreal. So nice to hear my name shouted and people yelling no-go tour and stuff. So,
any news on teams?
Still not yet. Still fighting, you know. Still trying to stay in the sport. Working hard. But
today won't have done you any harm. Watch your back here. You don't want to get run over by the FTJ bus.
Hey, thanks. just wanted to show myself today, you know, really. It was my best chance of doing it.
It was a break of very tall men. It was one of the few times you've been in a break and not looked so much taller than everybody else.
Yeah, it's actually, I've done that almost my third world, third time in the break. And the other two times it was like the easiest breakaway to get in. You just roll off the front and you're in it. But today it was a bit of a fight, actually. It was just quite hard to get in. There was a point where maybe I thought it was kind of all hell was going to break loose. But yeah, it got in there, and then it was a good group, you know, it was strong guys in that breakaway. So we got a big gap, and no one wanted to take it easy. So it was like, yeah, there was no point where we just like chilled for a bit. It was pushing on the whole time, to be honest.
Well done for showing yourself out there. And I mean, one of our most popular ever nominations for Pedlar de Charme, I think.
Oh, yeah.
There was calls for you and Larry. Larry's got one already, I know, but there you are. There's your Pedlar.
Thanks a lot.
It's a small,
yeah,
but I hope that fits okay.
Thanks a lot.
For a handkerchief, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, we're on the beach on my holidays. Yeah, definitely. Go surfing,
Conor Dunn there. And finally, before we go, we just something that we've covered a bit in the podcast has been the CPA elections and David Miller's bid for presidency to replace Gianni Bugno. Didn't quite come off. It didn't work. He didn't expect to win, and he didn't. Understand, we hear through cycling podcast sources that he has been asked to be vice president of the CPA.
And that he's considering it.
And he's considering it. So watch this space. But I went up there, and apart from watching a bit of the junior race with Gianni Bugno and David Miller, I intercepted one or two riders who came, not many came up, made the effort, because a lot of riders and teams were staying quite a little bit out of Innsbruck, so it was difficult for riders to get there to vote. And
well, we didn't even know where it was ourselves until the day before or the day of.
And it was kind of pointless, a lot of them voting anyway, because there were the block votes of the five big countries that really meant there were votes. Well, they counted for one vote, but that wasn't going to alter the result. Anyway, one guy who travelled an hour and a half to get there by train, taxi and foot was Tom Squeens, the Latvian rider. Here's what he had to say up at the CPA vote. Tom, I mean, you've made the effort to come up here. How much of an effort was that?
Well, an hour train ride from where we're staying, and then a little bit of pain to figure out how to get up here, because the hotel is not really in Innsbruck. And I ended up having to take a taxi because the bus is not running.
When did you find out the election was happening here?
Well, I mean, we knew the election was going to happen this year. But, yeah, the announcement was made pretty late. And the announcement about two candidates was made really late. And the two mandates were seen even later. Well, I mean, I think everyone's frustrated. But as Bugno said, they can say what they want, but they can't do anything about it. Well, he didn't say actually that, but that's kind of what he meant.
Is it frustrating as well, though, that because what the CPA would say is that the time to talk about changing the system was months or years ago rather than in the weeks leading up to it. Is that a frustration that it perhaps wasn't flagged and just talked about some time ago?
Well, I mean, it's the CPA's job to keep the bylaws up to date, isn't it not? And they should have maybe known this might happen. Like, not, it's not our job to read the bylaws and know every single detail. And if they had figured it out before and told that, okay, this is the situation, but they didn't even tell us that 30 days before, which was the time cut to change anything. So obviously, before, every single time, it's been only one person pulling the short straw and just getting the job, whereas now it's two candidates. So obviously, it's a little bit different. And finally, like, even if David didn't decide to go for the presidency, then probably another 4 years would have gone by and no one would have changed anything. And then suddenly, at some point, it would have broken. And, well, that some point was this year.
I mean, I spoke to a few riders at the Vuelta about the CPA, and they all felt that it wasn't an organization that was all that effective, and they don't have much communication with, and they didn't really feel that it represents them. I'm sure some do, but is that your feeling as well, that it's not an effective body at the moment?
Well, I mean, they're doing what they can, and they've done a lot of good things. I can't blame them for, like, the Extreme Letter Protocol has been great. Like, all the new things they put in the contracts with minimum salary and whatever, whatever. It's all great stuff, but there's some little details that actually are not that little and they need to figure out. Like, for example, I have two fellow Latvians riding for Pro Conti teams and they don't get CPA emails. Like, I don't know how that's possible.
Anything else? What else would you prioritize? If the CPA came to you and said, you know, what is it that you want us to do, what would it be?
I mean, it's just getting, like, all the riders the information and having the riders' input, not just six delegates having their input. And at the end of the day, it's only two of them, because with two, just Spain and Italy having their vote, it's over. Like, no one else really matters. So at the end of the day, it's just the French. And even the French delegate doesn't really listen to the riders. The French riders got a, oh yeah, FYI, we're voting Bugno. Like, that's, I don't know, like, there was no meeting for them, there was nothing. It was just like, yeah, guys, this is what's going to happen. Like, that's just BS.
So that was Tom Squeens. That seems like a long time ago now, the CPA vote. But we're wrapping things up here in Innsbruck. We're as wrapped up as you are in your black shawl, Orla.
I know, I've been taking this around my little comfort blanket with me because it's beautifully warm during the day and it gets quite chilly in the evening. So I've brought a shawl every day with me to cozy up of a soiree.
Have you enjoyed the 2018 World Road Race Championships?
I have loved it. I've really loved it. I'm quite sad that it's over. Just everything. I really enjoy World Championships because it's all in the one place. You've got everything from the elite riders to being able to watch the up-and-coming talent coming through. Everyone is in the one place, you know, in the world of cycling. So you get to catch up with lots of people. If you're lucky and it's somewhere like here, it's just been stunning. I've loved getting back on a bike again. We've been using the city bikes to get around all week. And I have had the most fun holiday. I mean work trip ever.
It's been hard work.
It has been. Well, we've worked hard, but it's fun. This isn't work. This is a privilege.
Highlights?
Ooh, highlights. Highlights, highlights. You sprung that one on me. Cecily at Trip Ludwig. Because I love her.
Just generally,
because she was just so full of energy and enthusiasm in the race. And she said immediately afterwards, I made loads of mistakes. I messed that up. I'm going straight home to watch the TV to learn from all of those mistakes. And I love that energy and passion for learning. And really just today. Today's race was brilliant from start to finish, and our experience of it was brilliant as well. I'm usually at bike races for TV and I'm stuck in a finish line in front of a live camera and don't really get to see very much. We've travelled all around the city, all around the race course throughout the last couple of days, and being able to watch it like that with a fan's eye view has been an honour. They've been my highlights. What's yours, Richard? Don't say me, because that's embarrassing.
Well, I think I like you. I enjoy watching the, you know, the junior races and the 23 races. It's great to get a glimpse into the future, and but also to watch those races with the guys that win might not be the riders who emerge as the champions. And I was, you know, I watched the junior road race with Remco Evenepoel, and he was the big favourite, and it was an amazing performance to win in the way that he did, and he came across as a very grounded guy, for all that it was quite an extravagant victory celebration, and he spoke really, really well. But I was watching the podium, and the two guys next to him on the podium, Meyerhofer and Fanciullo, the Italian, and they looked really quite upset. But I was looking at them thinking, you know, in 10 years, those might be the guys that we are talking about, because they often are.
And from
you
the
just don't know how these guys are going to develop, and sometimes these bright lights burn out and don't, because I think for him especially, he looks like a phenomenal talent. He's won a ridiculous proportion of the races that he started, but the point about that is he's not used to suffering. He's not used to getting his head kicked in, which is the reality of life as a senior rider when you turn senior. You know, he's got a few years under 23, and he probably do very well at under 23 level, but the jump then from under 23 to senior is enormous. And you know, Matej Morhić is a guy who won junior road race and then under 23 road race, and then really struggled for a few years, and suddenly his talent is really starting to flourish this year. And he's been patient, and guys with who are perhaps not as strong as him might have fallen by the wayside by now. So the real test for Remco Evenepoel, we've been debating this week with us, Evenepoel or Evenepoel, we'll find out.
Wait, I'm sure we'll find out.
You know, the real, it's going to be interesting to watch him and watch how his career develops.
Yeah, because champions aren't born, champions work at it. And
absolutely.
He's got a God-given natural talent, but it's how he recovers from the inevitable setbacks that are to come, and how he keeps a hunger through all of that.
Winning a junior road race is almost meaningless, I would even go so far
terrible
to say.
Terrible to say, but in the grand scheme of it.
But my highlight is Michael Woods, I have to say. Mm. I mean, winning a bronze medal, I think he is just, he comes across really well. He says what he thinks. He's very honest. And it's been wonderful to watch his development over the last couple of years. He's a lovely guy. And for him to be excelling in races like this is great to see. Fran Reyes, you're still with us. What's been your highlight?
Definitely, let me get carried away by chauvinism and recency to say that it has been the victory of Alejandro Valverde. It's been 38 years of fight, of riding, and of not giving up when things pointed out badly in order to reach this final sprint, this final 300 meters, where everything has come together. So, definitely this.
I think we were going to do a friend special last year on Valverde and call it the Pro's Pro, because if you speak to other riders and ask them who's the best rider in the world, an awful lot of them say Valverde. Mm. Unfortunately, Fran, we actually sent Fran to interview Valverde, and unfortunately, he refused.
What happened to that? Well, it was not Valverde who refused. It was his press officer who, for some reason, didn't fancy me at that moment in time. But, well, luckily, Valverde and I have a very good rapport, and I think I have re-established the relationship with Movistar team, so we might have a shot of interviewing him the next winter.
Oh, great. That sounds promising.
Yeah,
so watch
better deliver.
Space for that. Excellent. Well, that's all from Innsbruck, I think, Orla, apart from the two extras that we've got coming this week.
Indeed.
And Cycling Podcast Feminine.
And Cycling Podcast Feminine.
Which will be a bit of a bumper edition
as well.
Yeah,
I know, another one.
Lots of interviews in there, and that will be coming out on Monday the 8th of October, so listen out for that.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, thank you very much, Orla.
Vielen Dank, das war sehr schön, sehr interessant. Ich hatte viel Spaß, oder?
Cheers. Orla, as we walk home, we realise over dinner that we neglected to really give full credit to and respect to the two survivors of the breakaway, who really, I mean, I think they did a phenomenal ride. They were caught with about 25 kilometres to go, having been out front all day. It was an astonishing ride by the two of them, Vegard Stek Langen and Kasper Askren.
And no, not only did we not give sufficient respect and credit to them, we gave none whatsoever. And they were in that original break of 11, and Conor Dunn was saying, you know, it tends to be his thing, certainly World Championships, to get into breakaways. And he was hoping that once that had been established that the pace might settle. But even in the break, he said that they pushed really hard. So the fact that they shed riders one after the other and then made it to just the two of them, and they stayed out for such a long time, you know, it was phenomenal riding from the both of them.
A great ride, a really good ride by both of them. So, yeah, that was an oversight that we've hopefully put right. And as we walk home after another delicious meal in Innsbruck, we realised also we didn't really talk about much about the food, but you finally got your schnitzel tonight.
I did. I was desperate for an Austrian sausage and a schnitzel, and I've now had both, and I feel very satisfied. The food in Innsbruck has been delicious. Really nice, actually. I'm liking the pickly element to things. Very warming sort of mountain food, and every night I get to the evening and say, yeah, I'm exhausted. I'm a bit sore all over. I can't really be bothered. I'm not going to eat that much, and I'm going to go home at a decent time. And every night I fill my belly to twice its capacity because the food is so good. It's been lovely. I'd love to come here in winter. It's very hearty food, isn't it? Very comforting. I feel like all aglow after every dinner. I feel just generally happy. It's lovely.
I've had a lot of venison. They seem to like the venison here. Buffalo's tasting, though, it's a very popular feature of our Giro coverage. And on the wine, we've had a lot of local wine, but my highlight was the other night when we asked the waitress about the wine, and we asked her for a recommendation, and she pointed to an Austrian wine, asked her what did it taste like, and she said,
wine.